Hello everyone, Ian Gardner here with another news show. We are coming to you on Monday the 20th of September. It's just after lunchtime. It has been 3 weeks since we did our last news show. There has been so much going on. What's been happening? Well, look, personal first, I had a birthday. I turned 50, which feels kind of old, but still alive. So that's good. Yeah, Gelix, which is the VC I'm with, we finally did a first close in our fund at $22 million from over 120 people. So really delighted about that. Yeah, and we're out like many other VCs recruiting for an investment associate. So if you're interested, to check out gelix.vc. Look, it's boom time in the news. So loads of great stories that we're going to touch on. Who we've lined up, we have Stu Glynn. He is from 1013 in Brisbane. And we have John Henderson from Airtree. I partly brought them on because they can cover a lot of the stories. Some of the companies like Canva and Clipchamp that we're going to touch on are invested in by Airtree and 1013. So some good insights we're going to have. Now, I should note, we did have a woman founder lined up to join us, but unfortunately she had to cancel at the last minute. So I do apologize for the lack of diversity here. But yeah, look, I touched on it. Canva is now valued at more than $40 billion. That's probably the most exciting news out there. I mean, $40 billion is huge. It's more than Fortescue or Telstra or some of the other big companies that you may have heard of out there. Yeah, and loads of other things to talk about. So rather than me run through the list, let's jump over to the show and hear from Stu and John. So here we go. Okay, welcome to the news special episode. I'm here with Stu Glynn, all the way from Brisbane at 1013. Welcome, Stu.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ian. Great to be online.
Yeah, no problem. And John Henderson. First day back after paternity leave, partner at Airtree. Was it a month you had off?
Yeah, I had a full month off while Karen, my wife, went back to work. So I'm just warming back into the saddle. Thanks for having me, Ian.
Yeah, and this is day one. So but you haven't been idle. You've been brushing up on a whole bunch around decentralized finance and NFTs. Has that been your pet hobby?
I don't know if that's just a paternity leave thing or a constant hobby, but yes, I've been buying some JPEGs.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, no, definitely. Every time I looked at Twitter, I could see a lot of activity from John Henderson around NFTs and whatnot. So yeah, a couple of stories to talk about there. So look, we're 3 weeks since the last episode. So there has been a lot happened. We were kind of settled in the run sheet until the weekend, and then the news came out, which I think we should probably start with. Christian Porter has resigned, using quote marks around resigned. I think he was kind of pushed, taking $1 million in non-declared free legal advice from someone you pretend that you don't know. Kind of a bit smelly, to be honest. So there's no surprise that he kind of got out. Len, I don't know about you guys. I mean, it's probably unfair. I'm probably easier to talk about this as I'm a VC as well as a commentator. But from the startup industry's perspective, it's kind of, we are absolutely the poor cousin. You know, we've got straw coming out of here in the corner, and the government doesn't seem to care. I mean, this Christian Porter was the eighth minister or seventh minister in 8 years, which kind of suggests that it's not a portfolio that counts too much. And then it's been replaced with a temporary minister in the form of Angus Taylor, who I don't think many of us in the startup sector respect too much. I mean, I don't know the guy, so I shouldn't speak too critically, but you know, he appears to love coal, which I don't think any of us believe too much in. But we had Alex McCauley on the podcast a while ago. He was behind Startup Oz and now the Tech Council. So hopefully the Tech Council can step in and start agitating that this really should be fixed. But let me ask the unfair question to you first, Stu. Any thoughts on Christian Porter and what the government should be doing in this portfolio?
No, I just think that obviously I think he's on the way out from a departure perspective. So it's probably more about Sir Angus Taylor coming in. But I think it's also just Tech Council Australia, you know, having a seat at the table, having some actual credibility, having from a lobbying perspective. Because I feel like technology, even in just if you look at the last couple of months, what's happened in Australia has been nothing far from incredible in terms of like the growth, the success stories, you know, Afterpay acquisition by Square. There's Canva raising, which I know we're going to talk about at a $40 billion US dollar valuation. We're talking about Clipchamp, you know, being acquired by Microsoft. But there's a cloud guru. There's a handful of stories there, which is starting to show that, you know, we're not sort of like a cottage industry as such. You know, a lot of us have been working here, I think sort of 5 or 6 years. But you know, you guys have been around, you know, for longer in terms of supporting the space, but it's starting to actually show real credibility and real success stories. And hopefully, the sort of success pushes, you know, more of an agenda from a sort of government perspective and a policy perspective to actually get more people involved in the space, to be more proactive around it. So I feel like it hasn't really been on the agenda, and therefore, like, you know, it's kind of been pushed to the side. And so keen to see where it takes us. Commenting on Angus, I don't know him from a bar of soap. So I'm really, only sort of got the news last night of what was happening there. But I didn't expect Christian to be sitting in there for too long. It didn't seem like he was, you know, overly passionate about the seat. So hopefully, you know, it's filled by someone who's pretty passionate and wants to help sort of build the tech sector here.
I mean, there's some amusing quotes from Ed Husic. He's the opposition spokesman. He's been on the podcast too. He's a lovely guy and a sort of consistent voice from Labour around innovation. He said the only record Christian Porter broke as industry minister was his short tenure at 173 days. And then he went on, we hold our breath until the next person in Mr. Morrison's circus of incompetence arrives in the ministerial wing. So maybe slightly harsh, as you'd expect from an opposition member. But John, let me ask you the unfair question. What do you think?
I think it's a shame. And I think we deserve better. You know, Canberra is now worth more than Fortescue, Rio Tinto, Newcrest. Atlassian just pushed through $100 billion. We're not some pipsqueak in the corner who doesn't contribute to GDP anymore. I think we're a real job creating industry, and, you know, we've known that we're building the jobs of the future for years, if not decades now. It'd just be great if those in power would recognize the impact we're having.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure Scott Morrison is listening to this. So, Scott, if you're listening, can you please prioritize this and give us someone good? There you go. All right, let's move on from the political commentary to some real news. So we'll maybe start with Immutable. So Immutable is, I don't know how you best call it. It started as a sort of game trading company. So you could trade on the blockchain in-game items. So, you know, if you were playing World of Warcraft, for example, it's not in that game, but you could buy a sword that you could actually link back. So it's kind of the first iteration of what are now known as NFTs. I think it always had been known as NFTs, but you kind of know all about it. They have just raised $82 million in a pretty huge round. John, what, you know, as the NFT or DeFi crypto expert in the room, what do you make of this one?
Well, we invested, so that probably says what I made of it.
There you go.
I'm very excited about it.
All in.
Yeah, so as you said, Immutable started out with their own game, which was Gods Unchained, which is a game you could play on the blockchain. They built their own side chain because Ethereum's layer one, you know, has a bunch of problems, which I think are pretty well known. The throughput is slow and the gas fees are high. And if you want a gaming use case to work on the blockchain, then you need to fix those things. So Immutable fixed those things for itself and then realized that there was a whole bunch of other game developers out there who also needed scaling solutions for NFTs. And so they're about to launch the Immutable X token. They've launched the Immutable X platform, which a whole bunch of other game developers are building on. And so if you believe in the metaverse and you believe in digital items accruing value, then I think this is the platform play behind that. So we're thrilled to be involved. And I think this is an industry of the future.
Yeah, and a pretty remarkable founders, two brothers, James and Robbie Ferguson. James has been in the Summit group of ours for all the way since the start. In fact, I think you were both at Venture Down Under when we kind of unearthed these guys back in New Zealand. It must be 3 years ago now. Is it three or four? My God, I'm getting old. Might be four. And he came over and like, he was one of the smartest people in the room for sure. He'd never really played much poker before and almost won the poker tournament. And just this lovely guy. And it's just been amazing to watch the development of that business and how they have sort of pivoted into, you know, much more of a sort of SaaS-based software business for the NFT. Stu, any thoughts on this? Is this an area that you're interested in?
Yeah, definitely interested in the space. I think one of the guys is actually penning an article about the metaverse at the moment. So we were on some content and we're having a chat about it last week. But I remember meeting James, you know, at that Venture Down Under and just thinking, this is the type of guy that's going to build something super interesting. This was before it kind of NFTs in the general space was kind of blowing up. I'm not surprised, I guess. We looked at it. We didn't really understand it probably 3 years ago, and we're probably only coming up the ramp at the moment. But I think that they, you know, very talented, very, very talented guys when we spoke to them. And I remember them just knowing their space exceptionally well. And so it's a credit to them. I think it's very exciting and keen to see where it goes. It's, you know, the space is heating up for sure.
I think that's a very fair comment, right? Like backing two guys building, at that point, not a platform, just an NFT game 3 or 4 years ago was not an obvious thing to do. But when we look at founders we want to back, we say this a lot. We try and back people who see the future before the rest of us. And James and Robbie are a classic example of that. You know, they've been heads down building an NFT game and an NFT platform since 2017. And yes, they're in the right time at the right place now in the middle of JPEG summer, but it's not like these are two Johnny come latelys. They've been really building for a long time. So that, I think they deserve the success they're having.
I really do wish them the best. They're both lovely, lovely people. And so young. I mean, I think James is just under 30 and Robbie's 23, 24. So when they started this business, I mean, you know, go back 4 or 5 years, they were super young. So it's just great to see talent like this coming through and just growing with the business and being able to stay ahead of it and just do such a great job. So
I think you're going to,
congrats to the Immutable guys.
I think you're going to increasingly see that in DeFi and NFTs, to be honest. And I think the more teams I speak to, the more I realize how little background matters in crypto and how a lot of these people are DeFi native or NFT native. And so increasingly, I think you're going to see people from either unconventional backgrounds or no backgrounds really break out in this space.
Yeah. And in fact, I mean, we'll maybe just take a sort of 2-minute diversion into this. I mean, there was actually a good article in The Economist this week. I don't know if you saw it, John, but it was called Down the Rabbit Hole. And they did a whole in-depth thing around the DeFi, decentralized finance and NFT. So the whole concept was, who do you trust? And in the existing, you know, non-DeFi world, it's central banks and other authorities that issue money and you can trust them that that's not going to go away and they're going to back it. Now it's backed by developers who have created code that everyone can see and everyone can trust. So it's essentially subcontracting that trust. I mean, there's so many implications that go beyond that, John, just around, you know, lending and title deeds and, you know, all the stuff that's being now built on the blockchain. And as investors or as people that have been involved in this industry for a long time, I mean, blockchain, I remember it must be 5 years ago, just about every startup pitch you saw had the word blockchain in it, often for no particular reason. Yep. But now it seems to be coming back. So it kind of fell off the hype cycle and now it's right back on. I mean, John, like, can you just give us a perspective on what you're seeing and what you're excited about in this decentralized finance space and NFTs and whatnot?
Yeah, I think framing it as the hype cycle is interesting. I made my first investment in kind of crypto in 2013 when I angel invested in CoinDesk. And that's when I got into Bitcoin and then Ethereum in 2014 and 15 and so on. But it was all PA because it was, I think what we do as venture investors is try and intercept technologies when they're inflecting. You know, you have this long installation phase when infrastructure gets built out and then people actually finally start using it. And we go up what we call the S-curve and we're trying to invest in companies or projects at the beginning of that S-curve. And so I think what you've said is right, Ian, that, you know, I've been looking at blockchain for 8 years and not really made fund investments until the last year. And that's because exactly what you just said, like all of these projects were building tools around provenance and property registries and all of the ideas that are sort of starting to work now back then and they weren't working. And so what's changed, I think, is first DeFi summer in the back end of 2020 and now JPEG summer in 2021. We suddenly have people using these protocols. And so to your point on lending, you know, if you add up Aave and Compound alone, I think you get to $30 or $40 billion in value lent. The same is true across a whole bunch of other traditional finance applications like options and swap protocols, interest-bearing sort of assets, all kinds of really interesting things are happening in DeFi. But the point is that they're getting usage now. And so what am I interested in? What are we interested in? It's kind of the same things we've been interested in for 5 to 8 years. It's all the benefits of decentralization applied to finance, which means removing inefficiencies, removing a reliance on centralized third parties and creating a better financial system. But most importantly, it's usage. Like it's traction within the protocols and actual value being generated. And that's really happening now.
Yeah. And it is becoming a, you know, a bit more real world. I mean, everyone's heard of Bitcoin and Dogecoin and a few other things. And I can't remember the stats and how many, you know, what percentage of Australian millennials own crypto assets, but was it like a third? Am I right with that, John, or 20%?
I don't know the number, but that sounds,
number?
I believe that. And I'll bet you a non-trivial proportion of that now own JPEGs.
Right.
Yeah. So I can give you like a story. Yeah, we caught up with one of Australia's sort of emerging exchanges. These guys called SwiftX. So two young guys started building a sort of broadly an exchange or a broker. And they had 30,000 users around sort of December last year. They've got not 340,000, I think, is the last count of users, and totally Australian only. And so trading all the different coins, basically, and just with a good kind of like customer service. But yeah, amazing product, very simple, easy to use, but for everyday person can, you know, sign up and start buying coin. But just an incredible sort of journey that they went on, bootstrap the business. I think the guys are both sort of mid-20s also. And so as you said, Ian, the, you know, young folks have been able to build pretty amazing things. You know, it doesn't matter what your background is. And just, yeah, so Brizzy based, and I think they have over 100 staff, just like tripled their team, and, you know, without taking on external capital, it's been awesome to see.
And it's definitely not going away. I mean, the overall total, you know, global value of crypto assets is $2.2 trillion. El Salvador has now mandated Bitcoin to be available as a legal currency. And then there's a couple of other interesting, metrics in that Economist article. The value of digital instruments being used as actual financial collateral is $90 billion. So, you know, away from the actual dollars. And then the value of transactions that Ethereum is verifying in the last quarter was $2.5 trillion, which is the same amount as Visa. So, you know, these are not trivial stuff. So it is coming. You know, I think for a lot of people out there, it's past them. You know, I think if you talk to anyone in their 50s and 60s in finance, then they're like, you know, this, you know, I'll be retired by the time this comes in. I think to John's point, this is a young person's game. And I think that's where the future is. So anyway, let's not go too deep in that. I mean,
I'm not entirely sure I agree with that. I think it may be true that older generations will require a smoother UX or a better front end. But I think if you're saying that 50 and 60 year olds won't use DeFi, you're basically saying they won't use fintechs. I think if someone...
Maybe I'm saying they don't understand it right now.
Sure. But if someone turns up with you with Aave Pro and offers you a 5% yield on your Australian dollars, I reckon you'll think about that. And I think most 60-year-olds would.
That's true.
So I think there's elements of DeFi that haven't quite made it into public consciousness yet. But once you go down the rabbit hole, which is how we started this conversation, you just realize it's a better experience. Like, I can go and get a loan 24/7. I don't need to go and get credit checked. All of the stuff is online. The same is true for any application I want to use. On, you know, I could go on Mira and trade public equities 24/7 from my desk using a private key, not trusting a third party. I think regardless, it may be true that, you know, crypto natives are younger today, but give it a few years and I think this will be all pervasive.
Yeah. All right. Before we move on, John, any reading material that the audience who wants to get into more should look at?
Oh, let me give you some ideas to put in the podcast notes, Ian. I feel like if I rattle that off the top of my head, I'll do a disservice to it.
All right. No,
I think Jack's actually posted something from Airtree with a bit of a primer recently.
Oh, that's a great point. My partner Jackie Bullings' Substack. Thank you, Stu. That's a good place to start. Yeah. And we'll put some more stuff in the podcast notes.
Yeah, and Jax was in the AFR last week. She had a caricature done for in the Chancelier column, which was awesome. I thought that was really good. Although those caricatures are never that flattering. So poor Jax. Looks a lot better than that. Don't worry, Jackie. Look a lot better. Right, let's move on. So look, probably the biggest news in the last fortnight really was Canva. I mean, Canva is the gift that keeps on giving, you know, especially if you're Airtree, Blackbird, or SquarePeg, and anyone else that got in at that, you know, $10, $20 million valuation not so long ago. I mean, it was six years or thereabouts. So they just passed $40 billion, having raised a round of $200 million. You know, so if you were an early investor in, you know, like Blackbird or Airtree, you know, you're probably looking at a 3,000, 4,000 times return on that capital, you know, on paper. I get it. But at some point they probably will list and that will become real. And it's just like any way you look at it, it's just an incredible founder. I mean, there's another part of the story, you know, we'll maybe talk about that second. Let's talk about the impact in the sector first, but I do want to talk about philanthropy. So John, Airtree is an early investor in Canva. You know Mel and Cliff probably better than any of us here. Like, tell us why it's so special and what it means.
It's just a phenomenal company. I mean, this is what we've all been waiting for, right? Like, we sit on panels and we talk about building iconic world-class companies from Australia. And I think what this shows is Atlassian wasn't a fluke. Canva is one of the most important private companies in the world. It's one of the best SaaS companies, public or private, on almost any metric. I mean, they started in 2012, I think. They have 60 million monthly active users, 2,000 employees, 120 designs are getting created a second. They're on track for $1 billion of high gross margin ARR. It's just a phenomenon. And we, as you said, you know, we were lucky enough to invest in one of the early rounds, and we've invested in every single round since. And, you know, if Mel and Cliff turn up and offer us anything, we'll take it. It's just, it's an incredible company, brilliant execution. And I think Melanie will go down as one of the great entrepreneurs in history. You know, she's had a vision of democratizing a design. If you look at all of her communications since 2012, they've been completely consistent along that vision. She's got more ambitious over time as she's performed, but she's been true to the original vision from day one, and they've just executed better than almost every company on the planet.
Yeah. And Stu, let me ask you about the impact on angel investing. You know, I mean, I'm thinking Blackbird Fund One. I mean, Blackbird Fund One had, you know, approximately 100 individuals as LPs in the fund. You know, each of them are, and again, I don't know, because unfortunately I got asked to invest in that round, but I didn't have any cash at the time. So it's kind of like one of those stories. It's like, oh, I wish I had, but you know, it's probably, I don't know, 500 times, a few hundred times that initial capital. I mean, that's going to be boom time for the Australian economy, because most of the people in that first fund, like they are in 1013 and, you know, from a personal perspective in Gelix, you know, you want to see them getting a big return, because they are the ones that are going to go out and start redeploying that capital into new businesses, either themselves or investing in others. So do you want to touch on the impact on the ecosystem from that financial perspective, Stu?
Yeah. I think a good friend, Rain Ong, who basically is one of the investors in there, put out a post, and he's quite a prolific angel investor in Australia. And he posted, I think he was even quoted in the AFR around this, basically around like that is investment in Blackbird Fund One has done better than any of his other single investments that he's made of his whole angel portfolio as a, you know, like a pure sort of multiple metric, I would say. So, you know, 100% there's going to be an impact in turn from an angel investing perspective, not only that, but also from staff within Canva. You know, there are multiple people in there that have options that are now, and I think we have some of them actually investing through 1013. But this is what's happened in like places like Silicon Valley, right? There's been amazing success stories that they go full cycle, you know, they IPO or get acquired. And then the investors and the staff of those businesses and founders then go on to kind of, you know, redeploy and go on to their next things, but a lot of the time they go and support the ecosystem, and that's the wheel that happens. And I feel like, you know, we're only on the early stages, and Canva is just a phenomenal story. So, you know, I guess totally agree with John on in terms of his sentiment around that story. You can't, you know, it's a once in a sort of decade company, if not more. And I think even like, you know, Atlassian just cracked $100 billion for the first time last week. And Canva's managed to do that and, you know, get up to 40 in quick succession. And so, you know, who knows where that business ends up, but it's just an incredible story. And I do think there'll be a huge amount of impact. I'm really starting to see it, I guess. You know, as I said, we've got a couple of folks, from Canva that are employees that are actually, you know, joining on to start angel investing through 1013 with us. And so I'm sure there will be more, just because of, you know, I guess that filtering of cash going back into the ecosystem.
Yeah,
it's probably worth it. I mean, Canva is a phenomenon clearly, and it's clearly the best private technology company in the country by a long way. But this has been a pretty magnificent year for unicorns, right? Like, we had a Cloud Guru sell for $2 billion. Go One just went through the $1 billion market. We've got another in our portfolio that we'll announce soon that's $1 billion. I think Judo, Big Commerce IPO'd, Scala Pay, which we'll talk about. You know, what other period in Australian startup history could we have talked about 7 or 8 unicorns in September?
It was like Message Media got acquired for like, I can't remember, it was $1.3 billion, I think.
Yeah, I just feel every time I'm on this news podcast, we are talking about substantial, you know, it's not just about the you know, the uplift in valuation. It's just the ability to build a business from Australia in a pandemic, it's just extraordinary. I mean, I was talking to a founder this morning. It's like everyone has headwinds, but equivalently, everyone has tailwinds. And it does feel like for our sector, the tailwinds have outweighed the headwinds overall in the last couple of years. Like, I mean, if you're in travel or events, it's been a bit tougher. But for most of them, it's been just a boom time, which is great. Look, we should touch on the other interesting bit about the Canva announcement was the philanthropy aspect. I mean, Mel wrote a blog post, and I suspect she did write it. I suspect she's a good writer. And, you know, there's a really nice bit in it that she kind of summarized their overall objective. It's, you know, I think it was stage one, build one of the most valuable companies in the world. Stage two, do good with what you've built. You know, and the reality is, I think Mel and Cliff have announced, and John, you might be able to correct me if I'm wrong, but they've announced that they're giving away most of that, of the value that they're going to do, and they're going to put it towards philanthropic aims. And I know, look, Daniel Petrie, who's one of the founders at Airtree, I mean, he is strong on this point. I mean, he talks about philanthropy and, you know, Australians' historical ineptitude or reluctance to be philanthropic once you've made it. But this seems to be, you know, the younger generation being public and changing that tide. John, any thoughts on this philanthropic piece?
Yeah, I mean, Mel announced that they're giving 30% of Canva stock away by the Canva Foundation. At today's valuation, that's $12 billion that will go into the Canva Foundation. My understanding is that makes it the biggest foundation by a long margin in the country. They've already announced a couple of initiatives that they're doing immediately, but this is phenomenal, right? A company that was created 9 years ago has just contributed $12 billion plus, and it's definitely plus because Canva will continue to increase in value, which will make change around the world. And so I think this is a new form of capitalism, and it speaks volumes for what Mel and Cliff want to do for the world.
Yeah, no, it's just, it's so good. And, you know, I think I saw on the, you know, again, it's not really, and certainly for them, it's not about the wealth, but I think they were higher than James Packer. And when you can pair, you know, I don't know what he's done for the philanthropic world, but you see him, you know, beaming into the Crown Inquiry from a super yacht, you know, looking not very happy and not very healthy. And you compare that to the energy and exuberance of Mel and Cliff, who are still in the thick of it. I mean, they're still young. I mean, they've got plenty of time to go, and I think they'll be running this company for a long time. You know, Mel has talked in the past about building a $1 trillion company. I mean, there's still significant upside in this business. Stu, any thoughts on the philanthropic piece?
Not too much to add, because I think it's amazing. You know, 30%, I'm not sure what that is on their actual holding, but I would say it's a strong proportion of what, you know, Mel and Cliff are still own. And I even saw, like, I think last week, Cliff, we've got a couple of African investments actually, and could see him already inquiring around Africa and how does he get further distribution, whether it's, I don't know if it's for Canva or for the foundation, but basically showing a lot of interest into, you know, millions of people in Africa. And you could see that I was wondering what the alignment was, and then this sort of came out, and I thought straight away it's like from a foundation perspective of how to support sort of those emerging economies, etc. So look, I think it's a credit to them, and I think it's definitely, you know, is a material sort of shift. Even when things came out, which was like, you know, the 1% pledge, which is like, you know, 1% of profits, 1% of your ownership, etc. This is, I would say, what, I'm not sure, ballpark figure over 50% of what they own, if not more. So I think it's just incredible that they're making that sort of move.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. Anyway, good on you, Mel and Cliff.
And Ian, just before you wrap on Canva, I think it's worth just highlighting that this story is not even close to done, right? Like, we've invested in every single round, including the last one, and we're venture investors, which means we expect to see multiples on that investment. So I think Mel's right. This is kind of just the beginning for Canva. It's incredible.
If they get to $1 trillion, you're going to get 20 times your money, which is not to be sniffed at in any investment scenario. Anyway, good on you. Clipchamp. So, Stu, this was an early investment. Was it actually done under the 1013 brand, or was this Steve Baxter on his own earlier?
It was done both.
Right. The punchline is they got acquired by Microsoft. So maybe you can give us the backstory there.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, so we backed Clipchamp probably about 4 years ago when they did their kind of post-seed round. Well, we did through a transition level, which is Steve Baxter's family office. So I used to head that up alongside Steve. And then, Steve joined the board. We supported those guys, I guess, from that stage. And they ended up doing a Series A with Tola Capital, a Seattle-based fund. And sort of a product-led business, actually very similar. They used to pitch as be like the Canva for video. And they had a product-led approach. They went from when we invested, I think, the first time, a couple of million users to 17 million when they were acquired by Microsoft. And yeah, Microsoft, they had a great partnership with them. And I think they've got very exciting plans for what they want to do. Clipchamp was in the midst of a Series B sort of fundraising process and sort of explore their options. And Microsoft came in over the top and sort of said, look, we want to have, almost a C for Clipchamp for video next to what we have for Excel and PowerPoint. We're missing a slot there and we have a huge distribution system. And would you be open to having a discussion about it? And so we had to sort of review that at a board level. And I think it was definitely the best decision for the company for where they were at and the options on the table. But just a fantastic story for, an outcome for the Aussie ecosystem. I think showing that you can, a product-led business, I think I'd say close to 100 staff, 90% of them are based in Brisbane. From a technical perspective, they're no sort of sales team and, building product, and effectively all of those folks are now obviously going into the Microsoft ecosystem, but just amazing to see what you can build from Brisbane, yeah. Australia, and become, I think, the first acquisition from Microsoft into any Australian business. And so, yeah, fantastic story and good to see those founders. I think it was an 8-year journey in the end, to get to that result. And yeah, like we're stoked for those guys and think that there's going to be more to come. They've got some exciting news coming up soon enough. I'm pretty sure they'll be announcing, as part of the Microsoft ecosystem. And so I think that, as with the Canva story, it's a very different direction. But I think that the distribution through them is going to see that product, be used by a lot more than 17 million users very soon.
But it's not the first time. I mean, Microsoft invested in Go One, which is another Brisbane business, didn't they?
Yeah, so Microsoft has invested through M12, but I'm not sure if they've acquired, from an acquisition perspective. So Microsoft's actually invested in two other of our companies, M12, which is Go One and Arcos Labs, which is our cybersecurity business, and actually one more, Schedulo, which are all three Brisbane-based businesses, which is kind of interesting.
Did it help having a Seattle-based investor to get the attention of the Microsoft acquisitions team?
Look, I think that it was helpful because they knew how to run the process. A couple of those people, so Sheila Gulati, who actually was the sort of managing partner of Tola, was the she used to run M&A at Microsoft, so she knew the aspect there. But I guess it wasn't the genesis. The genesis was they had a partnerships team in Seattle, Clipchamp did, and they were doing a lot of amazing work for launching their product and sort of from a partnerships perspective. And they just came knocking at the door through that, and then back channeling through, we could kind of understood that they were serious. And so we decided to run that as a sort of dual track process at the same time as doing a Series B fundraising and talking to a bunch of funds on going out to market for their Series B.
But a great result. I mean, I think every journalist in the country has been hammering the company and you to get a disclosure in the acquisition number. And I'm not going to ask you that because I get why it's secret. But, if you've got 100 staff and you're growing fast and you're in the tech space, I mean, it'll be hundreds of millions of dollars. So it's a really great outcome for you. Congrats, and the ecosystem. And I guess it's another statement about Brisbane. I mean, I think I put out a tweet in this. You got Go One, Schedulo, Clipchamp, Octopus Deploy, Safety Culture even. I mean, like
Brisbane. Tritium's about to go and do a SPAC at sort of multi-billion-dollar business. So yeah, there's some really exciting companies.
Punching above its weight, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I think we're... I believe so. We're obviously biased because we're based in Brizzy, but we do get to see a lot of these companies and I think there's more coming. So yeah, I mean, not that we only sort of focus on investing in Brizzy founders, but it is always nice from when there's someone local to home that you can support and see, go on that trajectory.
Yeah. John, any thoughts on this one or Queensland?
No, nothing beyond what Stu said. I would just echo all of that. I think what we're seeing, and maybe this is COVID induced, or maybe it's just an acceleration of a existing structural trend, is that you can build phenomenal companies from anywhere. And, Brisbane is a small but meaningful city and is showing that you can produce multiple multi-hundred-million-dollar outcomes, which is fantastic. Yeah.
Now, that is a beautiful segue, small but meaningful cities. Wollongong, So a great company in Wollongong called Scalapay, which I hadn't heard of until I read this article, which is probably my bad. But they've just raised $210 million from the US, Tiger Global, who love putting big bets on companies, valuing it over $1 billion. So it's kind of in the buy now, pay later space. Who wants to touch on this one first? I can't remember what we said before we started. Stu, you look like you're about to talk, so I'll go with you.
Look, to be honest, I didn't know about Scalapay either. So, but we haven't followed the BNPL space. It's been so hot. We thought, look, that race has been run, obviously, with a whole bunch of sort of great success stories coming out of Australia. But then, yeah, the news of that Tiger Global sort of leading this round. It's probably the biggest Series A if coming out of Australia ever, maybe, or close to. And yeah, BNPL is just a super hot category. I think one of our investors actually, who's sort of one of our angel investors at 1013, sent us a note basically saying that he was helping them with their pitch deck, or for seed pitch deck in like 2019, I think. He didn't actually invest, so he was sort of kicking himself at this point after the fact. But look, we don't have too much to add other than another very significant business that's, well, you know, raised a lot of capital to go and sort of build out. And so it feels like these are constantly sort of coming through, and we're just like, you know, even though you think you're covering the market as best you can, and things like this pop up and just go, wow.
Yeah. And John, Wollongong, I mean, you touched on small but meaningful, and as VCs, we're always looking for the diamond in the rough. I mean, what did you make of this one?
Wollongong is absolutely not the rough. There is, there's at least one other company I know about right now doing a transaction in the hundreds of millions. So things are happening in Wollongong. I recently discovered the Slack group called Silicon Valley, which actually has more than 1,000 people in it, which I thought was hilarious. But it just shows that these startup ecosystems are happening everywhere, and success can happen outside of Surrey Hills.
Yeah. No, anyway, look, congrats to the Scalapay guys. Another great news story. Let's go on with some more good news stories. In fact, both of you, so 1013 and Airtree, invested in Delegate Connect in the last couple of weeks, which is an events platform. So like during pandemics, events platform you might not think of as being necessarily hot stuff, but there's obviously something in this. John, why did you invest in Delegate Connect?
Yeah, we're excited to both be invested here. So this is a seed round, $10 million. Across our funds and Skip Capital. Look, I think what COVID shows us was that we need to rethink how events are run. The days, and this is a thesis which I guess will play out over the next few years or not, but it feels like the days of having to attend a conference in person and get on a 15-hour flight and book a hotel and do all that stuff are over. I think there are certain conferences for which you'll do that. I think there's other conferences for which you might send one person from your organization, but three or four other people from your organization might want to benefit from, you know, attending some of the sessions or online networking. And so I think the vision that Delegate Connect is working towards or building towards is a future where events are kind of hybrid. You know, the in-person component is important and that will continue, but it probably needs to be augmented with a digital experience. And whether that means people in a room and people online, whether it means, you know, online networking combined with physical networking, it feels like that hybrid of digital and physical was going to happen at some point, but I think COVID has made us realize it's going to happen sooner rather than later. So Delegate Connect is building a platform for exactly that. And I think last I spoke to Doogie, he was moderating an event for a medical conference in Yokohama out of their studio in Melbourne. So it just sort of shows how global we are.
Yeah. And Stu, what got you excited about this one?
Yeah, I think it's just the team have built something great. They've got incredible sort of traction already. And when Jordan, who's the CEO, pitched it to us, he kind of explained the way he thinks about it, and it just made sense to me. It basically said it's almost like a sport, you know, a live sports event. You've got the speakers who are the players on the field. You've got the live audience, which is in the stadium. They're basically watching it live and sort of engaging, you know, want the atmosphere and networking. But you've also got a broadcast all the way out to, you know, all parts of the world, which are interested in the space and interested in, you know, in that particular area and want to attend the event, but can't do for whatever reason. And so he said, you know, the future events is going to be hybrid. It's going to be a mix, and you get far better distribution and across the board with this sort of tool and platform. And so I think, you know, just the runs on the board they've already got from a global nature, the quality of that team and what they've built so far was awesome. And so it was great to co-invest with Airtree on, I think, you know, we've invested in quite a few together, but a couple of recent ones together in Mr. Yum too. So it was awesome to be part of it.
Yeah. And look, as an events organizer, like we're Innovation Bay here, I mean, like we believe in hybrid events. In fact, John, I think when COVID was still raging a few months ago, I mean, we started doing them from your fancy new office in Surrey Hills, and we loved it. I mean, we had 30 people in the room. We had all of our live streaming equipment, and we'd have 100 to 150 people watching live online. And so look, we didn't quite nail the whole, networking. It's much easier to do it in person. There's no doubt about that. The human piece is really important. And I don't know whether it's a fair analogy, but it's kind of like, you know, having a shitty instant coffee versus, you know, your barista poured double shot latte from your favorite cafe. You always choose the latte, but if you really need a coffee hit, you're going to hit the instant. And I think this is playing into that. And, you know, I think it's a really good initiative.
I don't know if that's inevitable though, Ian. Like I've had the number of shitty conference experiences which I've had where I've walked around the floor and bumped into a whole bunch of people who I was wasting their time and they were wasting my time. I do feel like there is an opportunity to build a better networking and connection experience online, or maybe some hybrid of online and offline, which I know Jordan and Doogie are focused on. So I'm not saying that in-person events are going away, but I think they can be improved, and I think the digital experience can be really improved.
Yeah. Now, look, I don't think anyone's got the right answer. If the right answer was there, I mean, that's why we're in the game that we're in, and everyone who's listening is in this game. Like, we've got to invent the right answer, and it's out there, and it's great to see some Aussie innovators doing that. So, yeah, good on you, Delegate Connect. InsurTech just raised $31 million Series B to go global. Launching in New Zealand. John, I think you've got a little insight here. I think you've invested in InsurTech in the past. I mean, what do you make of this one?
You're talking about Open. I think Open is an InsurTech company. Yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. No, I'm asking you about that because like you have some experience in InsurTech, don't you?
Yes, well, we led the seed and Series A rounds of this company, so I know it well.
Yeah, there you go. That's exactly right.
So, I mean, they've just raised, as you said, $31 million in a Series B. This is really just an international expansion story. So the round was led by Movac. They're expanding into New Zealand. The round was also participated in by Local Globe and Latitude, and they're expanding into the UK. It's a great story. This is basically Stripe for insurance. You know, they provide the rails for insurers and reinsurers to reach out to their customers, both directly through Huddle, which is their own platform, but then they also work with people like AHM, Telstra and others to get embedded in their channels. So it's another great Aussie fintech, which is just kind of quietly doing its thing and then announcing $30 million rounds.
Yeah. Now, it seems to be all we talk about here are success stories. I mean, is it fair to say that not every investment that VCs make is a success? I mean, like, is that worth reiterating or talking about? I mean, and everyone's going to say that their hit rates are much better than their lack. But, you know, if you don't have some misses in your portfolio, are you trying hard enough as a VC? Stu, let me ask you that one.
Yeah. No, I totally think it's like a risk and reward equation. And in the venture category in particular, you know, there has to be wins that, like, you want to sort of have outsized return on some, and there's going to be some that, you know, don't make it for whatever reason. And that's the way your portfolio goes. And so we have to, you know, with 1013, we've got angel investors that sort of back deals behind us. And we need to kind of educate on the fact that if you put on, you know, investing into one business, you know, there's a likelihood that you might lose all your money on that particular investment. So, you know, they're not all success stories, but it doesn't mean that that you shouldn't be playing in the category, I guess, because there are some amazing stories, as you said. And then the other one, as I remember when we sat down, like even it was probably a few years ago, and you were sort of moderating the session at Venture Down Under, and we were talking about how many exits who's had exits and how many exits. And it was kind of a topic conversation because things were trending in the right direction, but it hadn't really sort of monetized, if that makes sense. And what we're seeing now is that kind of coming full circle. And there are, you know, there have been exits, investors are getting money back, as well as plus more, and there's a good opportunity ahead. So you know, I think it's also the market is pretty frothy. There is a lot of capital around, and so that capital needs to be deployed. And therefore, you know, it's a good time to be a founder and raising capital. I would say one of the best in history. But it doesn't mean that there's not going to be outcomes. Because I think on the flip side, we've also seen that a lot of these venture-backed businesses, or just large software businesses in general, have had outsized returns and almost the size of those markets are bigger than expected, like far bigger than expected. I think like the Shopify Bessemer memo, when they invested at Series A or Series B, they thought an upside at the best case was sub $1 billion. And I think the last time I checked, they were over $100 billion market cap.
Yeah,
and so,
right.
You know, it's one of those things where I think that there's great options on the upside, but on the there, it definitely doesn't work out for everyone. And you know, that's the case at the very early stage when you're trying to sort of change the world with your, you know, entrepreneurial business idea.
And John, I think we rightly talk about the successes in shows like this. I think we'd be pretty miserable if we just came on and started saying who's gone bust or not made it. I mean, are we viewing risk in the right way? Like how do you and Airtree think about risk when you're building a portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, it's a news show, right? Not many startups put out press releases when they don't raise rounds. So I think there's something a bit meta in there. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think Stu said it well. Venture portfolios almost all fall along a power law distribution, where a handful of companies provide the returns and the rest of them not so much. I think the thing that we focus on the other end of that spectrum is making sure that founders and companies fail gracefully, and ideally not in a way that has material mental health impact, or, you know, frankly, financial impact. And so I think the experienced venture firms do a really good job of finding outcomes for founders and helping companies, you know, not get in the bad side of the press, right? So there's an art to the bottom half of the portfolio, but it's a reality of the business.
All right, look, I think we've got time for one more topic here. And, you know, it's an interesting one. This came out in the AFR, and I think it was Lauren from Startmate who was on the show last time who talked about it. You know, and it's kind of entitled, Wealthy Doesn't Mean Sophisticated. So the reality is, and Stu, I'll throw this to you because like you, 1013 and Gelix operate, you know, and Investable and a few others operate in a similar space where in order to be an investor in the fund or in the syndicate, you need to be sophisticated. And the test for that is, do you control $2.5 million of net assets or have you earned more than $250,000 in the last 2 years? Not in total, but per year for the last 2 years. That's right, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah. So like, is that... Yeah. And should there be a change to that? Because that is blocking out either young people or people who are really interested in it or just people who want to become rich and sophisticated but haven't done it. You know, you can go down to the casino if you're not earning much money and put $10,000 on the roulette table, no one's going to regulate you for that. That seemed more risky to me than backing a pretty good fund manager in this. So Stu, did you read this and what did you think?
Yeah, no, I read it and commented a bit about it in support, I guess, of Lauren on this concept. So, I mean, look, I mean, 1013 exists and we take a sort of real network-based approach and we think there's more value to be created if there's more people involved from an investing perspective. And so, you know, we have close to 300 investors on 1013 at the moment, but we turn away a lot of folks because they don't meet the sophisticated investor test in Australia. But, you know, as you said, these could be people that work that are sort of, you know, quite senior at a startup and they haven't actually sold their shares or they, you know, effectively. So we often are, I guess, turning away people that we think, you know, should meet a test of some like shape or form. So in the US, for instance, that they've like reduced, I guess, the thematic here. So I think it's, you know, $1 million in net assets in USD. But then in addition to that, they also have like it's more of like an experienced investor aspect where you could take a test and sort of deem yourself to be sophisticated enough to know what's going on so that you're allowed to kind of participate in as an accredited investor in the US. And so, and the similar thing has happened in the UK. And so I think that like an easing of the rules on that perspective makes sense to me. It'll enable more people to get involved in the category. And a lot of these people are already working and actually want to, you know, take part in it. And a lot of folks technology has impacted their lives, and they want to get exposure to the space. But with failing the sophisticated investor test, which is a certificate provided by your accountant, a lot of folks don't even have accountants when they're working at late stage startups, etc. So I guess from our perspective, we're definitely bullish and think that it would be helpful to make those changes for the right reasons, not necessarily just to get every man and his dog to start supporting venture as a category, because it is high risk and we know this, and you do need to take a portfolio approach and all of these kind of aspects. But in essence, we do think of democratization and having more people at the table is more valuable and more helpful to all these companies that we're supporting. And so certainly think that there's room for movement on from a legislation perspective.
And John, are the tests too strict? 2.5 million, 250K, is that right? Should it change?
I think we need to be careful here. I mean, I agree with the view that the people who can add the most value to startups aren't necessarily rich people. And that was the whole idea behind our Explorer program. So I'm fully on board with that. But I also think it's worth pointing out that if you bought an index of startups or if you bought an index of venture managers, you would lose money. There's a lot of bad startups out there and there's a lot of bad fund managers out there. And so opening, just completely relaxing the rules is a very dangerous thing to do. And I think consumer protection regulations are there for a reason. So I don't know what the answer is. I agree with the notion that there are a lot of people who don't meet the test that would add a lot of value and should be allowed to invest. But what that means for the regulatory framework is probably above my pay grade.
Yeah. No, it's pretty hard to put an asterisk behind a law and say, unless you're investing in a good fund or a good startup who's not going to rip you off, because, you do need to draw the line somewhere. Well, I don't know. Like, from a personal perspective, I do think it's a little too strict and it should be dialed back a bit, with the right protections. I don't know, again, what exactly that looks like, but it does feel tough. And I would like to see this being democratized a little more. There were some equity crowdfunding rules that came in a few years ago, but it was so onerous. I mean, we looked at it with the Gilex hat on, and it was just, to get through the hoops and get your AFSL and all the rest of it was just ridiculous. And we decided not to and went down the sophisticated path. So we definitely blocked out a few people that could otherwise have got in. But, we've been, a bit like you, Stu, we've managed to build a business with a long list of investors, even within that sophisticated test. All right, look, anything that we've missed, guys? Anything that you want to announce that we haven't covered? Any news going on? John, your first day back, so like, what's on the do list?
Oh, I think I'm in an announcement free zone at the moment, Ian. nothing from me.
Stu?
Yeah, from an announcement perspective, we actually do have an announcement. We've got a one of the investment team within our business, Arne Vo, has actually been promoted to a partner.
Oh, awesome.
So super exciting for Arne. He's been with us sort of, I guess, for the last like 3+ years. It's been awesome leading his own deals and things. And so it's going to be great to add him to the partnership at 10:13, and we're about to kick off a bunch of hiring, from an expansion perspective, because I think like the model seems to be working really well. So looking forward to putting out some roles pretty soon on the investment and on the operational sort of deal side. So looking forward to sort of kicking that off.
Yeah, there's a lot of people out there hiring. Like Gilex has got a role open at the moment for an investment associate. And we put it live on Friday. Already had 100+ applications. And John, you just finished a bit of a round of hiring, didn't you?
We did. Yeah. We're always beefing up the investment team. So we have finished a round of hiring and we are hiring, I think we're hiring 5 or 6 roles at the moment.
Well, it is, venture. It's not the most glamorous job in the world. It's less glamorous than people think. It's not like suits in the legal world equivalent, but it is the best job in the world because you do get to help, founders and make an impact and, you don't have to get your hands too dirty in terms of operating the businesses. So I don't know. I don't know about you guys, but I think it's the best of both worlds. I certainly prefer it to being a founder a few years ago.
No, I love it. It's awesome. Although I kind of think that we're our founders ourselves and trying to build. So 1013 is only 18 months old. So, you know, in essence, we have some of our own issues as along with, but yeah, it's amazing. You get to work with such awesome people and a lot of variety and, people creating products that are changing the world. So,
yeah. Oh, well, look, that's a great way to sign off. So look, Stu, John, thank you. Great to see you both. Hopefully in a few weeks, we can go and have a beer together.
Looking forward to it.
Although you're in Queensland, so I don't know, they'll probably keep the border shut. We'll see you next year, Stu. But John, I'll see you soon.
Thanks, guys.
All right, see you, boys.